All righty, we're underway then with session 11, starting on page 92 of your notebook. So let's do a little bit of review, see where we were. We're in the third major section of our study, the end of exile, 1839 to 1947. Last week we were introduced to David Ben-Gurion, the man who would become probably most associated with the State of Israel. Also, we were introduced to Dr. Arthur Rupin, who was in charge of the Jewish National Fund office in the land. He was in charge of finding and buying land and starting settlements in Israel. One of the key settlements that he was instrumental in beginning was Dagania up in northern Israel, on the very southern tip of the Sea of Galilee, became the first kibbutz in the land, and its success inspired the rest of the kibbutzim. We were introduced to Yitzhak Ben Zvi. He will show up more importantly later on in the study. But at Yitzhak Ben Zvi's apartment, a number of young Jewish people gathered, and they were encouraged by Israel Shochat to defend Jewish land. You know, if we're farming the land, we should be able to defend it. If we can't defend our own land, how are we going to possibly build a country? And so he was the seminal man, the man who started what eventually became HaShomer. And here's a picture of the 23 of the 26 Shomerim, the guards, the watchmen, that eventually began protecting settlement after settlement in the land. Pretty soon they had well over 100 people, and they were in many, many, many settlements in Galilee, Samaria, Judea, on the coastland. Tel Aviv was founded just to the north of Jaffa on a sand dune. A number of people gathered and drew lots for plots of land. And on this sand dune, Tel Aviv was born. By the 1930s, it was a thriving city. And, of course, here's the way it looks today. Israel's major metropolitan center. Over 4 million people in the greater Tel Aviv area. Major city. Returning back to 1914, World War I began, and the Ottoman Empire entered the war on the side of the Germans and began to harass and expel Jewish people in the land in the Ottoman Empire. So many Jewish people left and went to Egypt, which was controlled by Britain, not part of the Ottoman Empire at that time. And they decided to form a regiment to fight against the Turks. This is one of the, recruitment posters. Bat Zion, daughter of Zion, saying, "We need you. Bat Zion needs you." We also learned about the importance that the Suez Canal had in the British Empire and in its strategy, the Suez Canal, bridging the land bridge between the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea. A very, very strategic and important waterway. And this will come into play even more as we go through our study. The British decided to encourage the Bedouin Arabs in the Saudi Arabia, in the Arabian Peninsula at that time, to fight against the Turks. So they would send liaison officers in to support the Bedouins. And the most famous was Colonel T.E. Lawrence of Arabia. He worked with Faisal, the Emir Faisal, of the Hashemite tribe to fight against the Turks, and they were very successful during World War I. During World War I, Sir Mark Sykes, on the British side, worked with Charles Francis Georges Picot to carve up the Ottoman Empire into spheres of influence. And they were anticipating victory. And so they carved up the Ottoman Empire, the Middle East, into various areas of influence. The red area would go to the British for British control and British rule. The blue area went to the French influence and French control. The green area to Russia. And the area we call Israel today became an international zone to be ruled by all three of the countries. Now remember, the borders we see on this map are the modern borders only. They only approximate the zones of influence at the time. So it's the colors that are important on this particular map. And of course, remember the red is the area of British control, blue the area of French control, and then the area we call Judea Samaria and Galilee today was to be an international zone ruled by Britain, France, and Russia. No Israeli state there, no state of Israel there, no Palestinian state there. Just an international zone governed by three different countries, okay? There never has been a Palestinian state in that area. Never has been. It's always been a province of a greater entity. We were introduced to Chaim Weizmann, the British Zionist and scientist who created a method of formulating acetone, an important ingredient in explosives that helped Britain win the war. Very influential man who had access to the highest men in power in the British Empire, one of them being David Lloyd George, who would become Prime Minister, a Bible-believing Christian, and Arthur Balfour. And because of Weizmann's influence on David Lloyd George and Arthur Balfour and the Bible's influence, God's influence in their lives, the Balfour Declaration was issued. And this is the letter that Balfour wrote to Lord Rothschild, who was heading up the Zionist organization at that time, stating that the British government would try their best to establish a homeland for the Jewish people in the area called Palestine, 1917. And I mentioned to you at the end of the class that the Balfour Declaration is hated by the Palestinians and is being attacked even today, some many years later. With this news article, for example, of many attacks, but just one news article to show you an example of what's going on. 27 August 2013, British Christians, and of course those would be replacement theologians, British replacement Christians who feel that God is done with Israel, that Israel has no future. British Christians denounce the Balfour Declaration, claiming it's one of the greatest mistakes in history. So that brings us now to page 92. Middle of page 92 in your workbook, the British capture Jerusalem. So it is now October 1917. We're nearing the end of World War I. In October 1917, Allenby launched his invasion of Palestine. And remember, we saw a drawing of Field Marshal Edmund Allenby last week. Here is a photograph of him. You have this portrait in your notebook. But he was the general launching the British forces into Palestine. Now, the initial phase of the campaign was successful beyond the general's highest expectations. It went very, very well. Augmented by tens of thousands of Commonwealth troops, the Egyptian expeditionary force struck quickly in the interior of the country, overrunning Beersheba, capturing Jaffa on November 16th, and finally taking Jerusalem 3 weeks later. And on this map, here is the route of the Egyptian expeditionary force as they very successfully invaded what was called Palestine out of Egypt. They secured the Negev by capturing Beersheba. From Beersheba, they went north and secured the coast, capturing Jaffa. And with the south and the coast secure, they made their strike for the center of the country, conquering Jerusalem just 3 weeks after conquering Jaffa. So a very, very quick and efficient military invasion. And then when Allenby entered Jerusalem, he got off his horse and he entered Jerusalem on foot because this is the holy city. He was not going to enter Jerusalem with an attitude of arrogance, but with an attitude of humility. So this man was influenced by the Bible as well. So here's a very famous picture of Allenby walking into Jerusalem on foot in humility, not in arrogance. And of course, this is a black and white that has been colorized with watercolors, very popular technique before color photography was invented. So it gives you an idea of what it looked like. Now on December 11th, Allenby marched bareheaded into the historic capital to address a gathering of Muslim, Christian, and Jewish notables, which had been convened on the steps of the Tower of David. Quote, "We have come," he declared, "not as conquerors, but as deliverers. It is our intention to open a new era of brotherhood and peace in the Holy Land." Great intentions, hasn't never been realized. Guess what? It was the anniversary of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the commemoration of the Maccabean triumph that had liberated ancient Israel and opened the Jerusalem, by the way, and opened a renewed era of Jewish national glory. That happened in 165 BC when the Maccabeans overthrew the Greeks. Now in December 1917, as menorah candles gleamed in Jerusalem and in Jewish homes throughout the world, observant Jews everywhere uttered prayers of gratitude for this astonishing coincidence. All right, page 93. Page 93, 1918, World War I ends. Top of page 93. Now, ultimately, when the British finally overran the last of the enemy's forces in September of 1918, the Jewish population had been reduced from its pre-war figure of 85,000 to less than 55,000. The country had been starved by an Allied blockade, ravaged and ruined by the Turkish forces. Scores of villages had been laid waste. Trees and orange groves were damaged. Public security all but extinguished. Now, the British naturally gave their first and most urgent attention to food supplies, which Allenby ordered directly imported from Egypt. The American Near East Relief soon followed with shipments of clothing and medicines for the Christian and Muslim populations, and the Zionist organization and Hadassah, its women's counterpart, matched these efforts for the Jewish community. Now, before we go on any further, I want you to turn your page to the slides, page 93B. And these slides speak about the biblical importance of World War I. Since World War I has now come to a close, I wanted to briefly emphasize the biblical importance of World War I. Handout 93B. We're going to start here with Matthew 24, verse 3, and verses 7 and 8. It says, "He was sitting on the Mount of Olives. The He is Yeshua, and this is the Olivet Discourse," what's known as the Olivet Discourse, the discourse on the Mount of Olives. "And the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us.'" Now they ask him three questions. One, "When will these things happen?" Two, "What will be the sign of your coming?" Three, "And what will be the sign of the end of the age?" Now Jesus doesn't answer these questions in order. He starts with question number three first, down on verse 7. He answers the question, "For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And in various places there will be famines and earthquakes, but all these things are merely the beginning of the birth pangs." Now what's the importance of these two verses? Next slide. The phrase, "nation against nation, and kingdom against kingdom," are Jewish figures of speech during the first century for world war. For world war. The term birth pang is a biblical figure of speech for the end of days. So, next slide. So, in answer to their question, when will the coming of the age be? What will be the sign of the end of the age? So, in answer to that question, basically, Jesus answers saying, "When you see a world war, that is the sign of the end of the age." World War I, then, marked the beginning of the birth pangs, the beginning of the end of the age. And we've been in the last days since 1914. And the rest of verse 7 tells us the characteristics of the age we live in. There will be famines and earthquakes. In other words, there will be wars and there will be natural disasters. That is just the age we live in, guys. You know, we have famines going on throughout the world now. We just had an earthquake yesterday up near LA, okay? This is just the course of the age. This is the end times that we're living in. So just accept that. Be aware of it. Not every battle you hear about is unique. It's just a characteristic of the end of the age. Yes, question.
Was there a the Jewish people considered a world war back in those days?
No, no, there's never been a world war until World War
One. They never experienced one, but they had a term for what they expected to happen.
Yes, right, yes, by looking at Scripture.
Christ used that.
Yes.
But they were familiar with that term.
Yeah, it was a figure of speech there for a world war, yes. Question. Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about Matthew 24.
Okay.
And the pastor was clear in saying that this chapter is already done.
This chapter is fulfilled. No,
yes.
No, it's not. I would disagree with him.
Absolutely. I'm disagreeing with him because right. So many things have not happened yet.
Yes, exactly.
And so it's very...
Yeah, Jose, I would definitely agree with you. This chapter is not fulfilled. There's plenty to come. In the Olivet Discourse. Yes, I agree with you. All right, now that's just a quick summary. If you would like to study this in further depth, I would advise you to pick up Footsteps of the Messiah by Dr. Fruchtenbaum. He goes through this whole concept in more depth in that book. All righty, let's return now to page 93, middle of page 93. Turn back one page. And Zionist Commission appointed. In December 1917, the British Foreign Secretary had approved the departure of a Zionist commission for Palestine to organize relief work and supervise repair of the damage done to Jewish colonies. Of course, that was needed because of World War I. So the commission embarked for Israel in March 1918. It was eventually given official status as an advisory body to the military government in all matters relating to the Jews. Of course, the military was governing the area as a reconstruction went underway. Note the next sentence, if you're following along. This is a mark-it-up moment. This is a good sentence to highlight with your highlighter. At this point in time, no one raised any objections to a Jewish national home in Israel, or in Palestine, or in the Ottoman Empire, or whatever you want to call it there. No one raised any objections. Now, France rejected British and Zionist claims to the headwaters of the Jordan, but the French Prime Minister did not dream of challenging the notion of a Jewish national home. Neither did the Italian government, where the San Remo peace accord was held. President Wilson was our president at that time. He remained firmly committed to the Balfour Declaration through the peace conference. He stated to Felix Frankfurter, a leading American Zionist, here's President Woodrow Wilson, and here's what he stated to Frankfurter. He said, as far as I have found, and so far I have found no one who is seriously opposing the purpose for which it, and that's the Balfour Declaration, embodies. Nobody was opposing the Balfour Declaration. When entrusting Palestine to British and Allied statesmen, the San Remo Peace Conference incorporated into their allocation award the verbatim text of the Balfour Declaration. They took the whole thing word for word and stuck it into their award. So the basic moral support of the Western governments appeared firmly established as a result. And for a while, the friendship of the Hashemite Arab leadership seemed equally beyond question. In January 1918, after the Balfour Declaration was issued, Commander D.H. Hogarth, page 94 or so, Commander D.H. Hogarth, research director of the Arab Bureau in Cairo, was dispatched to Arabia to clarify for Hussein the implications of the Zionist program. Sensing the potential financial advantages of Arab-Jewish cooperation, Hussein was enthusiastic. The sheriff issued the Jews several warmly phrased invitations to return to their sacred and beloved homeland. At the end of the year, December 1918, Sykes brought Weizmann and Faisal together in London, and each expressed mutual understanding and support for each other's position. The discussions and courtesies between them were ultimately formalized in a document signed by both Weizmann and Faisal. It was a pact envisioning a common stance at the peace conference. And here's what it declared. Here's what's called the Weizmann-Faisal Treaty. His Royal Highness, the Emir Faisal, representing and acting on behalf of the Arab Kingdom of Hejaz, and Dr. Chaim Weizmann, representing and acting on behalf of the Zionist organization, mindful of the racial kinship and ancient bonds existing between the Arabs and the Jewish people, and realizing that the surest means of working out the consummation of their national aspirations is through the closest possible collaboration in the development of the Arab state and Palestine, and being desirous further of confirming the good understanding which exists between them, have agreed upon the following articles. And then nine articles comprise the agreement. Nine more articles. And of course, here's a picture of Weizmann on the left and Faisal on the right when they met. And again, another picture of the delegation. There's Faisal with his entourage behind him. Do you see a familiar figure back there on the right? And there he is, Lawrence of Arabia. He's a part of Faisal's delegation. All righty. So this treaty was signed January 4th, 1919. As it turned out, however, Faisal expected Zionist diplomatic support against the French. It soon became evident that Weizmann was unwilling to act independently of his British patrons. I need to do what the British want me to do. I'm operating with them. By mid-1919, Faisal terminated his public meetings with the Zionists. January 4th. His January 4th treaty with Weizmann was not published, and the Zionists, respecting Faisal's wishes, withheld comment on it for many years. So increasingly disillusioned with the Zionist connection, the Emir chose now to envision the Jewish national home as merely a sub-province within the Arab kingdom. Here's what he said in the middle of that paragraph. You can highlight it. When some Zionists speak about Palestine becoming as Jewish as England is Jewish, they are really talking unreasonably. A big shift in attitude, isn't it, from the treaty? 180-degree shift in attitude from the time he signed that treaty. In late autumn of 1919, Faisal ceased public communication with the Zionist leadership altogether. His policy of invoking Jewish cooperation for Arab diplomatic purposes in Syria had failed. So he was pouting about it. All righty, the tide is beginning to turn right here. This is where the tide began to turn. 1919, we have pogroms in Ukraine and Poland. So pogroms are continuing, and we have on page 95 the third Aliyah. The third emigration wave. Page 95, top of the page. Although the population of the Yishuv had fallen to 55,000 at the end of World War I, the numbers were replenished almost immediately in 1919. And this influx became known as the third Aliyah, the third immigration wave. Jews poured in from Eastern Europe at the rate of 1,000 a month by 1920, and ultimately reached a total of 37,000 newcomers between 1919 and 1923. Most of these immigrants were simultaneously fleeing revolution, counter-revolutionary pogroms, and civil wars. That's a summary of back on bottom of page 94, where it says pogroms in Ukraine and Poland, etc. That's a summary of what was happening. Revolution, counter-revolutionary pogroms, civil wars. Of course, the end of the age had begun. The end of the age was moving along nicely. Many of them came under the illusion that a Jewish state was about to be established. All of them, in any case, regarded post-war Eastern Europe as a dead end for the Jewish people. Now, the Russian Revolution of March 1917 and the overthrow of the Tsarist regime initially ended all Jewish disabilities, and it removed shackles on Zionist activity in Russia. And it even led briefly to an unprecedented burst of Russian Zionist enthusiasm and growth. By early autumn, the movement embraced some 1,200 local groups and a membership of 300,000. But 1917 was Russian Zionism's golden opportunity, and it passed very quickly. It was cut short by the Bolshevik Revolution in November of 1917, same year. Now, the new communist regime, in its early stages, placed few limitations on Zionist activities. Palestinian immigration bureaus at first functioned without interference in major cities. And during 1918, some 4,000 Jews managed to depart Russia for Palestine. In December, however, the Yevsketsiya, I don't know if I pronounced that right, which is the Jewish section of the Communist Party, began to denounce the counter-revolutionary essence of Zionism. So they were not behind Zionism at all. These are Jews who are not Zionists. In February 1919, Zionist offices were closed, Zionist periodicals banned. Soon, a full-scale anti-Zionist crusade was unleashed in the Ukraine and other Jewish centers. And by 1923, Zionist organizational activity had all but expired in Russia, brought to a halt by the communists. Hechalutz. Despite the Bolshevik repression, an unusually effective Zionist emigration organization sprang up at this time. It was allowed to function in Russia during the early 1920s, and it was known as Hechalutz, the Pioneer. The organization's formal training program in Russia infused the Third Aliyah with a practical dynamic unique to Zionist history. The unique dynamic was pre-immigration agricultural training. That was their emphasis, pre-immigration agricultural training. Now, the notion of advanced agricultural experience was promoted widely by Joseph Trumpeldor. We saw him last week, didn't we? We met Joseph last week, the dentist who lost an arm and was a fervent Zionist, Joseph Trumpeldor. He returned to Russia in 1917. And at the outset, his intention was to recruit a Jewish legion for the liberation of Palestine. But in the following year, the Bolshevik Revolution aborted his plan, and Trumpeldor immediately issued another call to his admirers. Top of page 96. Here's what he said, top of page 96. If we cannot be an army, let us be pioneers. Let us sow the seeds of a handful at a time until we conquer the land of Israel. So build your agricultural skills. We'll conquer Israel plot by plot, garden by garden, farm by farm. That was his new call. So Trumpeldor warned his listeners that it was not simply enough to depart for Palestine to become workers or farmers. The pioneers of the Second Aliyah had followed this course, certain they could build a utopian society by sheer force of tenacity and willpower, and they had failed. So Trumpeldor instead urged Jewish youth to equip themselves in advance for the tasks ahead. They must train while still in Russia, cultivate the soil adjacent to their villages, learn from the farmers all about them. And at the end, he himself and a number of close associates traveled throughout Western Russia, organizing Hechalutz groups and establishing training centers in Minsk and Simferopol in the Crimea. Here's a map of the Eastern Europe. Of course, the Ukraine and Belarus and Lithuania and Latvia were all Russia in those days. And Minsk is located in the middle of Belarus today, underneath the sign Belarus. And yes, Simferopol is in Crimea that we hear so much about today. The point I'm showing you this map is they went throughout Eastern Europe, throughout the whole area where there was high Jewish population, promoting advanced agricultural training. They were not idle. They were busy, busy people. The result, tens of thousands of young men and women joined the organization during the summer and autumn months of 1918. Enthusiastically, they took up the study of agriculture, He purchased or rented tracts of land. They followed the advice of Jewish and Russian instructors. Now, the Bolsheviks tolerated this activity for a purely functional reason. It attracted badly needed American Jewish philanthropic funds. Now, in 1921, a World Hechalutz organization was founded. In 1925, Hechalutz membership had reached 33,000, and by 1933, 83,000. And as early as 1919, the first Hechalutz youngsters began arriving in Israel. And Hechalutz is still operating today. This is their website. If you're interested in perusing their website, there it is. Hechalutz, the pioneer, still a viable organization supporting Israel even today. All righty, what time do I have here? 1920. Why don't we quit for your break right at this time? We'll pick it up after your break with 1920 and the British granted the mandate over Israel. So go take your break. Listen for the shofar. All righty, we're back underway. And we're going to pick it up here on page 96 in your workbook. The British granted the mandate over Israel. 1920. Rarely had the fruits of military victory been as palpable as those savored by England when the fighting stopped. The end of World War I. By December 1918, 200,000 Commonwealth troops had planted the Union Jack in Syria, in western Turkey, Palestine, Mesopotamia, lower Iran. It was a swath of territory encompassing all the historic land routes between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. Now, Palestine would be awarded to Britain as a British mandate. And here is the area allocated. You have this map in your notebook. The area allocated for Jewish National Home at the San Remo Conference of 1920. Notice the size of the area. This is now officially Palestine. This is now officially Palestine, part of the British mandate. Notice at the top, Syria. That's part of the French mandate. And just going off the screen is Iraq. Again, part of the British mandate. So there's the original British mandate for a Jewish national home. That's the original territory. Now, just to be clear, what is a mandate or the mandate? You'll hear me talking about that a lot. The mandate, by definition, is a commission from the League of Nations authorizing a member nation to administer a territory or a region. Now, the purpose was to prepare and eventually release the territory for independent statehood. That's the whole idea. Okay? Administer a territory or region with the idea that someday they will be self-governing and be an independent country, independent state. Now, the Supreme Council at the Peace Conference formally validated this understanding at San Remo, Italy, April 25, 1920. Now, on the basis of exhaustive geographic and geological surveys, Weizmann and his Zionist colleagues asked the Supreme Council for a Palestine bounded in the north by the slopes of the Lebanon Range, the headquarters of the Jordan, and the crest of Mount Hermon. In the east by the Transjordan Mesopotamian Desert, and in the south by the Gulf of Aqaba. So here is the area. That's the British mandate. The Zionists said, we've looked that over closely. We don't need or want all that territory. Just give us this territory here. The Zionist request for a home for the Jewish people, Israel's historical borders. It's all we want. We don't want all that stuff. Just give us our historical borders, okay? That was the request. That was the approximate boundaries. Well, the French didn't like this. The French were not prepared to accept these boundaries. And on December 4th, 1920, the British and French prime ministers reached a final understanding on the boundary issue, And the accord represented a painful shock for the Jews. And here it is. Here is the Zionist request of a home for the Jewish people. And here is Great Britain's division of the mandated area in 1921 to 1923. That is the area. Now, notice on the left we have Palestine. And on the right we have Transjordan. So no longer is that area going to be given to the Jewish people, but the area has been reduced by about 75%. Okay? We'll talk more about that later on. Now, in the north and in the northeast, the country of Israel, the new country of Israel, Palestine, was deprived of its most important potential water resources, the Litani River. That's a key headwater to the Jordan, and the spring coming from Mount Hermon, and a greater part of the Yarmouk River. The boundaries similarly ignored the historic entity of Palestine as envisioned in the original negotiations leading to the Balfour Declaration. And moreover, by failing to approximate any natural geographic frontiers, the borders left the country perennially exposed to armed invasion. This heritage of economic and military vulnerability was to curse the Palestine mandate and later the entire Middle East for decades to come, right up to today. So we'll get more details about this decision when we get there. All right, Tel Hai. In August of 1919, Joseph Trumpeldor returned to Israel to arrange facilities for the expected influx of chalutzim, of pioneers. He lived in his kibbutz, Tel Hai, in the Galilee. So here's a map of modern Israel. The box on the left is expanded on the right, and you see Tel Hai way up in the panhandle, in the Israeli panhandle, way to the north there. That's where Joseph Trumpeldor was living. However, in 1919, fear and distrust of Zionist aims grew daily among the Arabs. Barbed Arab newspaper editorials began to appear. Public Arab threats and instances of unrest in Arab towns grew month by month. In February 1920, a party of Arab raiders attacked the Jewish colonies of Metula and Tel Hai along Israel's northern border. These two settlements were located in a gray area between the British and French zones of occupation. Page 98. Among those killed defending the outposts was Joseph Trumpeldor. And he's considered an Israeli hero. You visit Tel Hai today, and you'll see this monument to Joseph Trumpeldor, the defiant lion, the roaring lion. And here's a close-up of that roaring lion, a monument to Trumpeldor. Now, his last words have been disputed. We don't know if this is true or not, but as he lay dying, you will often see that he said, "Never mind, it is good to die for our country." So he is considered one of Israel's heroes, whether he really said that or not. Some feel he did. Some historians feel it's just something was contrived. Excuse me? Tel Hai. That's at Tel Hai. Monument to Joseph Trumpeldor. All right, page 98, the Arabs riot in Jerusalem. More ominously, it was the season of Nevi Musa, the season of the prophet Moses. Nevi Musa. It's a traditional Arab counterpart to Easter and Passover, where devout Muslims travel in pilgrimage on the Jericho Road to the grave of Moses. Incidentally, just for your information, it's a very unbiblical season and ceremony because Deuteronomy 34:6 tells us that no one knows where Moses was buried to this day. So Moses' grave there is fictitious. Now, the Arabs arrived in Jerusalem on April 4th, 1920. Soon a large crowd gathered to hear nationalist harangue by agitators, not all of them local Arabs, and they extolled the name of Faisal. Their purpose was clearly to influence the Allies, who were scheduled to assign the mandate at San Remo within the next few days. And the crowd became unruly. The Arab police joined in the applause, and the violence began. During the next 3 hours, 160 Jewish people were wounded. Eventually, British troops arrived and quelled the disturbances. The next morning, however, the instigators who had been detained overnight were released, and the attacks on the Jews promptly resumed. Order was not restored until the third day. A number of Jews and Arabs had been killed by then, and several hundred wounded. All right, Sir Herbert Samuel. It was in San Remo, a day before the assignment of the mandates, that Herbert Samuel was informed of his selection by Lloyd George as civil high commissioner in Palestine. And you have this portrait of him on page 98. Sir Herbert Samuel. He is a loyal Jew and he is a Zionist. He's supportive of the Zionist endeavors. And so his reputation seemingly emphasized the government's commitment to a Jewish national home. Now the appointment was obviously not without risks. Faisal considered it a provocation to the Arabs. You know, how dare you make the High Commissioner a Zionist and a Jew? Allenby, General Allenby, warned that violence would follow. But Samuel, Sir Herbert Samuel, arrived in Jerusalem on June 30th under tight security, and the misgivings and precautions soon appeared unwarranted. Most of Samuel's initial appointments aroused enthusiasm among Jews and Arabs alike. The Zionists were particularly gratified by Samuel's firm open-door policy on immigration. Remember, the Balfour Declaration did not restrict immigration in any way. Even Arab nationalists respected Samuel. However, the very impartiality proved to be the High Commissioner's Achilles heel. It was his obsession with fairness that influenced him to make conciliatory gestures to the Arabs. Far from satisfying Arab nationalism, the gestures only encouraged it. And so Arab restlessness throughout Palestine grew. Basically, he was so afraid that he would offend people that he caved into them. All right, I want to show you a map from Martin Gilbert's book, The Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. You can find this map in that book. And the map is called Arab Nationalism, Britain and Arabs, 1917 to 1971. It deals with Arab nationalism from 1917 through 1971. Let's read this little box up here in the upper right of the page. No, I'm not making you read it from your seats. The box reads, largely as a result of Britain's victories over the Turks in 1917 and 1918, more than 10 million Arabs were liberated from Turkish rule. Okay, 10 million Arabs liberated from Turkish rule. The total area of Arab lands in Arabia was 1,184,000 square miles. Palestine, the only portion of former Turkish territory set aside for a Jewish national home, covered less than 11,000 square miles. That's approximately 1% of the area. All right, here are some of the nations that were created by the British between 1917 and 1971. In 1971, Egypt became an independent state. Other Arab nations that were created, Transjordan, known as Jordan today, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Aden, Oman, Muscat, the Trucial States, Qatar, Kuwait, Iraq, Syria. These are all Arab population, basically Arab population, and Arab nationalism. They responded to Arab nationalism, and these new states were created. All right, let's talk about this paragraph, this box. I'm going to read that box, or I'm going to put that box up on the screen, but I'm going to use as a background the Arab world today. Because the Arab world is not just located in the Middle East. It also spans all across the top of North Africa. These are all Arabic-speaking countries. Now, Balfour had this to say. There's Israel, by the way. Can you see it? Can you find it? wasn't for that red circle, you would never see it, right? Okay, that's Israel amongst the Arab nations. Here's what Balfour had to say. So far as Arabs are concerned, as the Arabs are concerned, I hope they will remember that it is we, the British, we who have established an independent Arab sovereignty in the Hejaz. That's the Western Arab Peninsula. We've set up all these countries in the Arab Peninsula. Please, Arabs, remember that. I hope they will remember it is we who desire in Mesopotamia to prepare the way for the future of a self-governing, autonomous Arab state. We want to give you guys your countries. We don't want you to be under the thumb of any other nationality. We don't want to rule you. Okay? We want to set up realistic countries for you. I hope that, remembering all that, they will not grudge that small notch, for it is no more than that geographically, whatever it may be historically, that small notch in what are now Arab territories being given to the people whom for all these hundreds of years have been separated from it. Balfour, July 20th, 1920. I would hope that the Arab countries would not begrudge their Jewish brothers that tiny, tiny little postage stamp of a country we're going to give them. Look at the difference between the Arab world and the Jewish world. Okay? You can see why Balfour said that. It's fine, the Arabs, for the Arab people said it's fine to establish Lebanon and Syria and Iraq and Jordan, but not Israel. All the other countries, but not Israel. Okay? Seems a bit one-sided to me. Okay. All righty. Weizmann, elected president of the Zionist organization. We're now on page 99. The Zionist organization was in disarray following World War I. Its political machinery had ceased to function during the 4.5 years of hostilities. The central Zionist offices had remained in Germany, but the bulk of the membership in Russia. Now, Weizmann's stupendous coup in achieving the Balfour Declaration transformed London into the operative political headquarters of Zionism. So the headquarters now had to shift. It was Weizmann and his associates who convened a special conference of Zionist leaders in London, July 1920. The London conference soon took upon itself to elect Weizmann as president of the Zionist organization. So he's the new leader of the Zionist conference. Keren HaYesod established. At the London conference, Weizmann emphasized that the priority need in building the Jewish national home was knowledge, modern methods, and above all, money. For the purpose of gathering all important money, Weizmann and his colleagues on the Zionist Executive Committee authorized the establishment of Keren HaYesod, a foundation fund to tap the resources of diaspora Jewry. So Keren HaYesod got going then, and it is still a functioning entity today. United Israel Appeal. There's their latest website. So they're collecting money for Israel even today. Even today, a very active organization. Histadrut. Now here's an important organization. I'm going to spend a few minutes on this. The Histadrut founded. In 1920, the Jewish Labor Federation of Palestine, or the Histadrut, was formed. The essential post-war impetus for the Histadrut was supplied by two political factions, the Achdut HaAvudah and the HaPoel HaTzair. Achdut HaAvudah, the Union of Labor, HaPoel HaTzair, the Young Worker. These are two labor groups. They submerged their differences, and they tried to create an apolitical, a non-political, and purely labor federation. So on that basis, the Histadrut was founded in Haifa in December of 1920. It was significant that a majority of the Histadrut's early members belonged to kibbutzim and moshavim, and that the federation placed its heaviest emphasis on creating work opportunities for Jews in the land. So I've thrown a new word at you, moshavim. So what is it? Let me define that to you. You can find this accurate definition in Wikipedia. Up on the screen here, kibbutz, a kibbutz. Literally, gathering or clustering. Plural, kibbutzim. A collective community in Israel that was traditionally based on agriculture. So a kibbutz is one big farm. All right, and all the members belong to that one big farm and collectively, communally operated. Okay, make sense? One big farm. A moshav, plural, moshavim, a settlement or village, is a type of Israeli town or settlement, in particular, a type of cooperative agricultural community. So it's similar to a kibbutz in that it's an agricultural community, but it's an agricultural community of individual farms. So under the kibbutz, you have one great big farm where everybody cooperates. In a moshav, everybody owns their own farm and they operate collectively. See the difference? A moshav is independent farms cooperating. A kibbutz is one big farm. Make sense? Okay, that's the difference between a kibbutz and a moshav. But the idea is cooperative socialistic labor there. Now, the Histadrut began to organize strikes against planters who refused to give work priorities to Jews. So they really began to pour on the pressure. Not infrequently, pickets used strong arm tactics to induce Arab workers to return to their homes. So they intimidated cheap Arab labor. So the farmers would be forced to hire more expensive Jewish labor. Now, with the bulk of Jewish manpower pouring into the cities, the Histadrut increasingly turned its attention to the urban areas. It organized unions, not simply among manual laborers, but among clerks and technicians and doctors and lawyers. In 1923, the Histadrut established a central economic corporation, the Chevrat Ovdim, the Workers' Association. It functioned as a cooperative wholesale society to buy the products from the kibbutzim and the moshavim, and then in turn, through its chain of retail stores, to sell the farm products, the foodstuffs, the clothing, and the industrial goods. So we're now on page 100. In 1926, the Chevrat Omdim organized a marketing outlet, Tenuva, for kibbutz and moshav dairy products. Then a workers' bank, Bank Hapoalim, as its major credit instruments for the farm settlements and the labor enterprises. And, you know, all this stuff is still operating today. Here's Tenuva's website dealing with dairy products. They're associated with Yoplait yogurt there, as you can see. So Tenuva is still operating. And Bank Hapoalim, this is their website. You see Bank Hapoalim all over the place. Bank of the Worker, of the Workers, the Workers' Bank. So these are institutions that are still viable and functioning today. The Chevrat Ovdim's housing company, Shikun, provided workers with flats at the lowest non-profit rentals. The Histadrut forestalled the worst of the yeshiv's economic inequalities and minimized cutthroat competition. The Histadrut's most important innovation, undoubtedly, was the program of universal medical coverage. We know all about that, don't we? Known as the Kupat Cholim, the sick fund, it had been launched as far back as 1911. So they've been into socialistic medicines from way back when. In 1911, some 2,000 participants joined the Kupat Cholim on the eve of the war. Of course, it's all voluntary. By 1930, its membership had climbed to 15,000. The number would double to 30,000 by 1935. The Histadrut formed a school network in 1921. By 1934, 135 Histadrut schools represented 44%, almost half, of all the schools in the Hebrew educational system. By 1925, the Histadrut founded its own dramatic company, Ohel, and began publication of its newspaper, Davar. The Workers' Federation also launched a number of its own industrial companies. The most important of these was the Solel Bonet, the paving and building company. Way back in 1994, when I was in Israel walking along, and here I see this a building being built, and what do I see on the side? Soleil Bonnet, that's what the word is, Soleil Bonnet, the paving and building company. So I shot a picture of it. Hey, they're still operating too, you know? All of this stuff is still functioning. So the Soleil Bonnet drained swamps in the Jezreel and Hula valleys. They built roads. They erected housing and office buildings. And in the process, opened up thousands of new job opportunities. As early as 1930, the multitude of these activities drew into the Histadrut fold 75% of the Jewish working population in Palestine. Nearly all phases of a man's life, the life of his family, were embraced by the vast canopy of the workers' organization. By the eve of World War II, the Histadrut had become much more than a powerful institution in Jewish Palestine. For the majority in the Yishuv, the Histadrut was all but synonymous with Jewish Palestine itself. A very, very important organization in the life of the nation Israel. Well, we come to another important organization as well, the Haganah. We'll see how far we can get. We'll probably only get partially through this section on the Haganah. So next we come to the growth of Jewish self-defense. Now, an important consequence of the Arab uprising in 1920 was its effect on Jewish military activity. The tradition of self-defense went way back to HaShomer, the Jewish Watchmen's Guild of the 1900s. After the war, however, those members of the guild who had survived Turkish mistreatment were prevented by the British from bearing arms. Now, an abortive self-defense effort was initiated by Jabotinsky during the 1920 riots, but once more was suppressed by the mandatory authorities. You know, the British were in charge. Yet shortly afterward, the Achdut HaAvodah Party, the Union of Labor Party, the Achdut HaAvodah Party, appointed a special committee to establish a more widely based and clandestine self-defense organization known simply as Haganah, defense. It was understood that the organization would be broadly based, for henceforth defense clearly required more than the protection of an outpost or an occasional settlement. The entire yeshuv would now fall within the circle of Jewish security. Page 101, top of the page. Thereafter, the Histadrut assumed responsibility for the Haganah. Officers' training courses were organized. Weapons were purchased illegally from Europe and smuggled in. And eventually, secret armories were built for the production of light weapons. When we advance to the year 1929, we'll encounter more Arab riots. The riots in 1929 were a critical juncture for the defense program. It was evident now that training would have to include most of the able-bodied Jewish youth in Palestine. Newer and more modern weapons would have to be secured. Now, from the outset, the Haganah had functioned under the supervision of the Histadrut. Most of its leaders were Histadrut officials. Its membership was recruited almost exclusively from the laboring ranks. Operating out of a single room in Histadrut House in Tel Aviv, Haganah's headquarters became the embryonic Ministry of Defense. By 1936, it was receiving large quantities of Jewish agency funds. It was accumulating a large number of illegal weapons, and it was enlarging its program of military training. When the renewed Arab violence broke out that year, the Jewish military leadership decided at first on a policy of restraint. In practice, this meant simply that the Jewish communities would be defended vigorously without resort to acts of retaliation against Arab villages. However, Yitzhak Sadeh, the Haganah field commander, placed his own interpretation on the concept of restraint. And there you have a picture of Yitzhak Sadeh, General Yitzhak Sadeh. He included in his philosophy preemptive strikes. His young officers included such teenagers as Yigdal Alon and Moshe Dayan. It was Sadeh who taught his youthful commanders to plan ambushes and to organize mobile patrols and to anticipate Arab marauders by striking first. The shift from purely defensive to preemptive tactics was made feasible by an agreement newly reached with the mandatory government. Even before the worst of the Arab attacks, the British had raised no objection to the Jews accumulating a certain quantity of their own weapons for the protection of outlying farm settlements. As fighting gained in intensity throughout 1936, the Jewish agency demanded additional free legal equipment to protect its isolated farms and reorganized status for its own guards. Hard pressed for military manpower, the British administration, this is the British government, the British military, decided to grant these requests. Light weapons were distributed to some 3,000 authorized gafirs. These are uniformed Jewish auxiliary guards whose parallel membership in the Haganah and that the British accepted. Even more significantly, the man appointed by the British as operating commander of the gafirs, Captain Ord Wingate, vigorously and imaginatively enlarged Sade's concept of an active defense. And we'll pick up Ord Wingate and his contribution to the Haganah when we get to 1938. All right, page 102. We'll return to 1920 at the top of page 102, but we'll do that next week. And we'll pick it up with the National Assembly elected. So let me go ahead and close in prayer, and then we'll turn you loose. We'll see you next week. Father, again, I want to thank you for putting the right people in the right place at the right time and giving Wiseman, for example, wisdom regarding the needs of the new nation, and then moving ahead with all the practical needs so necessary for an independent and functioning state. So, Lord, thank you for your work in the life of the Jewish people and the life of Israel. And help us to always remember that you work in our lives in the same way. You bring people into our lives that provide for our needs and guide and direct us. And we're grateful for that. So help us always to be looking to you as we walk through this life together. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you guys next week.